Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started.
So these episodes are going to be a little bit different over August. We are going to relook at my favourite moments from the podcast from series one. We've had such amazing conversations this year, and thank you so much to everybody who has been on the podcast. You've been incredible, and thank you so much for all the listeners for your support so that we can continue this for series two from September. I hope you enjoy taking a look back at, yeah, my favourite moments.
I've just seen a message from a parent whose pupil is actually starting in my class in September. Oh. And they've said, should I write a list to tell you guys about my child? So yes, I send home, and this is relevant for everybody, I send home a happiness audit. It's on my Google Drive, but anyone that wants it, I'll send it to you. And it's basically a what makes your child happy audit. It's the first thing we give. So it's what sensory experiences make your children happy, what foods make your children happy, what environments make your children happy, what people make your children happy, what, you know, just what does heaven look like for your child? Because then we can refer to that, you know, if we want to support a child coming in from the car, or I don't know, anything throughout the day, we can look at the happiness audit and think, oh yeah, actually this environment is not ideal for them. Let's dim the lights, let's put on rock music, let's whatever it is that makes them happy. It just might help, it just gives us a clue. So for this one parent, you're lucky enough to have me in September. Anyway, but for any other parent or teacher that thinks they would benefit from that, I'll send it to you. So I'll save this obviously to my grid and comment below, and I will just make sure that's an automatic.
And as a, like, from the perspective of a parent, to know that you do that, and again that you genuinely care and are going to be supporting them with what makes them happy, that is just so incredible to hear. It's so brilliant.
Yeah. So if you're teacher or parent, I think it's, how can I, it's currency. Happiness is currency in a special ed class. Like, how can I assume that a child like Ethan will want to join our group area if it's not motivating to him and doesn't hit those buttons, you know? Whereas if it would be as easy enough as me, like, oh, okay, three of our kids like cats.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. I'm going to pick a story the first week about cats then. Like, it's so easy once you know.
And like Ethan loves 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what's they called, official, at the moment. Like, he loves counting it and doing it all on his ASE. And like, if we told you that, and you could think you could meet Ethan, and you could, that could be the song you sing.
Exactly that. Or in maths, like when we pick the music song, we can, because we do choice boards, we can just make sure that's an option. Because without knowing that that was his favorite song, we might even not have that as an option. And then even if he could understand the choice board or whatever, we're limiting him. So the more we know, the more opportunities, the better. And going back to your question of how long does it take to get to know a child, the more we know, we can build those connections, that trust.
And actually, it surprised me how quickly you said, but that's amazing. And obviously you're with them for such a long period of time in the day.
And our whole job is to get to know them. Like, those first weeks are literally, that is what we do. Okay. It is building trust. It's a lot of intensive interaction just to start building that trust, share the same language, and getting them to know the class, you know, within their own, not trying to stretch them too far. It's a real weird balance. Especially when you've got them all doing it at once. But the more we know about a child, the better. Don't think that sending him in with four A4 pages of handwritten information about him is too much. If you can't do that, don't, that's fine. But if you want to, don't think, oh my god, I'm that one. Please don't, because I'd rather too much information than not at all. And even if I can't read it that first day, because it's a bit hectic, if it's in front of his book stapled in there, at least we can refer to it.
Definitely. I think that one more question I was going to ask, actually, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
was just sort of what we can, is there anything we can do kind of during the summer? So for all the parents who have their children starting at special school, to just kind of support Ethan a little bit. So we know, I think, on one of his goals, it's to sort of be able to put his coat on and off. And
okay.
Is that kind of useful to do with him? Or
it depends on, like, some of them might give you specific goals, like some of them to work on specific things. I would say just really focus on the transition photos or videos that you've got. So if when next time you visit, video him in the space in the classroom if you're allowed to.
Yeah.
Or at least take photos of the adults and key workers he's working with, the entrance door, like really important like steps of how he's gonna get there. I think it's probably the most important thing, because your job is to get him through the door. And that's sometimes harder. I mean, it sounds like Nathan's doing brilliantly, but for some parents, sometimes just getting them into the car, dressed in a different uniform. Yeah. Like, you know, there is so much. So I think focus on that. Focus on practicing uniform wearing on and off, no pressure, new shoes, practice wearing new shoes, because sometimes they're a bit hard and horrible, aren't they? So wearing new shoes without any pressure of going anywhere. Yeah. Make it a bit of a fun game, maybe. Practice the car journey, parking in the car park and then going home again. You know, all those things. Actually, that's probably the most important thing, because your job ends at the gate, and then we're over summer, we are thinking about from the gate, right, okay, what's learning gonna look like? What's, but if you can get them to the gate on time, like wearing their uniform, whatever it is, that is awesome.
Brilliant. Okay, and it's so good to hear as well, you saying that our job ends and then you take over. I think, you know, for us, we've had a really funny kind of childcare history of like nursery not meeting his needs and stuff. So to just know that he's going to be somewhere where he's fully supported, he's understood, he's accepted, and his happiness is the main goal, you know, just so brilliant to just be looking forward to that and just sending him kind of safely sort of on his way.
And the more prepped he is, the less anxious he'll feel and the better day he'll have. Yeah, and if you've practiced over the summer and you're really concerned about, I don't know, like I've heard some awful things about some schools making children wear shirts and ties and I don't know, specific things. Like some schools do. Like, it is okay as a parent to voice your concerns, because you, again, you're the expert of your child. If you feel like them wearing a shirt is going to hinder them from even entering the building, in my mind, that's exclusion. Definitely. And it's absolutely okay to voice that and to keep fighting for that. For me, happy, well, my head teacher hopefully isn't watching. I'm happy if kids turn up in their pyjamas. I couldn't care less. If they're through the gate and they're happy and regulated, I'll work with it.
Yeah, that's real. But hopefully, I think probably as a parent, I probably expect specialist schools to be a bit more lenient with that. But as you said, if there's ones that are kind of forced.
Yeah, not always. It's not always. And also, like, sometimes it's we want children, sometimes it helps having a uniform, because then they know it's a school day or a home day, you know, like for some children it's actually very important. So often we kind of go for a mixture of, we have a white t-shirt rather than a white shirt, and they wear the school jumper and they wear jogging bottoms, like that kind of thing is quite typical in our class. So they are part of the school, they've got the logo, but it's a little bit, but I mean, it's so school, it really is school specific. Some other schools wouldn't, it's just up to schools. But also, if your gut feeling says that that is hindering your child from entering the building, I would say that's an easy fix. It would be a lot of red, it would be a red flag, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
definitely.
And I've always been special ed, so I am naive to what's realistic. So do you have three realistic resources that you could share with us, or support systems that mainstream teachers can start in their classrooms to support their either autistic or neurodivergent students in their class this year? We've just started a new year. What would you suggest they looked into?
Three is really hard. Okay, sorry. No, I was trying to think about it earlier. And I'm a talker, so try and get me to just say three. Really hard. I think, and it is really hard to think of three main things, but I think one of the biggest things is what you can do for the whole class to benefit the sort of the children who really need something specifically. So for example, if we're talking about children who need regular brain and movement breaks, then hit the whole class with that, because you're quite often going to be a teacher on your own with 30 children. and you're not just looking at like neurodivergent children in terms of who you need to support. You might have children in there with no English, and you might have children in there who coming from a really challenging kind of home situation and need your emotional support as well during the day. So there is a lot to do. And so for any teachers out there, like, please know that when, especially on my page, it's never about teacher bashing. It's system kind of, is the issue is the system. And I'm all for changing the system. But right now, we have to change it in the classroom, because if that comes, it's not going to come soon.
Yeah, so it's from the inside out, almost.
Bottom up. Mm. Like, it would be that way. So I think, yeah, what you can do for the whole class. So like in New Zealand, it's incredible. And they've been doing this so many years that they start every day with some form of movement, whether it's dance or, you know, aerobics or whatever. And it's just like part of every school. And so often I find that one of the frustrations with parents is that everything is different in every school, and it is down to the teachers. So any teachers out there, it's almost no excuse for why a child can't have brain and movement breaks really regularly. Brain breaks can be the simplest thing.
I say, have you got some examples of what? Because often I share, like, what I do, like exercise boards and stuff, or weighted blankets thing. Oh, we haven't got 30 of those. So could you share some, like, realistic mainstream?
Like a really short brain break would be, right, everyone copy me. And you'd just be starting to do different things. So you're switching, trying to get them to really concentrate, and it becomes silly. And you can get them to stand up and do it, or you can do it. I do it when they're on the carpet, right? Pens down, eyes on me, let's go. And we do this for like a few minutes, just anything, you know, five. And they shout out how many fingers I'm holding up. Really simple things like that, that you can do several times throughout, let's say in English, might be an hour long. Like, break it up with little brain breaks. Then you've got your movement breaks. Because brain breaks can be done when they're sitting on the carpet or sitting at the table. Movement breaks, obviously, you need to get up and move. So when they're going, you could do it maybe once on the carpet. When they're going from the carpet to their tables, do a movement break then, which also is kind of a brain break. So you're doing both. So a quick Simon Says is a really good, obviously, Simon Says, you do it as the teacher, you know, that's a really fun one to do as well. Or sometimes, yeah, in the middle. And then if you've got kind of a 15-20 minute section of the lesson where they're at their tables working, do something after 10 minutes. So in the middle of that, again, pens down, eyes on me, right, stand up. And then we do something just really physical. And to begin with, at the start of term, it takes a while. Like,
yeah,
they'll be silly. It's really hard to rein everyone back in, but you might be
so not it. You are. So these teachers that are hearing this, don't just try it once and think, oh no, that was chaos. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, it probably is chaos because it's something they might have never done before. But trust me that the more you do it, it just becomes routine. And so then when I would do it, everyone would know. And I did it in the middle of Ofsted. You know, I wouldn't be scared of that because I knew, everybody knew kind of what happened. We did this and then, right, everyone back to
it. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Renewed kind of, right, now I've got my idea. I'm going to go again. And so I think those sorts of things, when you've got, you know, especially reports coming in saying this child needs regular brain breaks, movement breaks, do it for everyone. Oh. Each child will benefit from that, especially younger children should be moving. So I think those are the things you can do, but also make games in your lessons. When you're doing maths or something in input, try and get movement games. So like I used to do splats where we'd run up and splat the board. I'd get them writing on whiteboards because actually if every child has a whiteboard and they're all writing and then you hold it up as quick as you can, or we tell each other, tell the person next to you and then let them go around the table, or things like that, that you can do, anything that you can do that is just breaking up, listening, I'm talking, you're listening, everyone's sitting. No, like that's just not going to be the most inclusive way. So many neurodivergent children. So I think if you can meet the needs of whether it's 2, 5, however many in your class, you do it on a whole class level, you're actually then ticking the boxes. All of them.
So everyone's benefiting, aren't they? No one's missing out then, because, and it's almost like you're catching it before they really, really need it. You're giving those regular input every, you said about 10 minutes. So every, you know, half lesson, those regular inputs. Means it never gets to dysregulation. It never gets to the point. It shouldn't get to the point where they're in absolute crisis and you're having to evacuate the classroom, or you're having to,
which,
you know, just focus on this one.
Yeah, and that's like my principle in pretty much all my coaching as well, is, you know, what can we do before? It's all about proactive strategies. What are we doing before our children are reaching meltdowns? What can you do before they become dysregulated? So have these regulation resets all the time, so that you're just letting that pressure valve out.
Rather than being reactive and thinking, oh,
I think you need a movement break.
It's too late. They're already in crisis.
Parenting, like, how do we parent when a child's having a meltdown? They're already in it.
It happened before. It happens before you do it. Yeah.
It's all the stuff beforehand. And it's the same in schools. Like, don't wait till anyone is dysregulated before you put in support. And so I think it's that thing, assume that they're all going to be dysregulated, or they're getting there. Assume they're frustrated right now. Because if you assume that they're getting there, then you can put things in.
And then even if they're not, it doesn't hurt.
It really doesn't hurt. And, you know, same with my son. If he's not angry, then I'll still be giving him opportunities to let out anger. Even showing me any anger. You know, these are things, this is like proactive parenting or teaching. It
never gets to the point where it's unmanageable for his body. I found it on inset day. I don't know if any other teachers here found that. But we were sitting for 45 minutes at a time, and then we had a break for 45 minutes. And I thought, my goodness, I am really struggling. Like, after 15 minutes it was, I mean, I'm neurodivergent anyway, but I could look around me and I could see people like playing with their scrunchies, wiggling their knee, like fidgeting in their chair. And I thought, we've had enough, and we're adults.
Yep.
How are we asking these 5-year-olds or 11-year-olds to sit for such a long time? We need to be practicing what we preach always in those inset days, don't we? So if you're leading on those trainings, we kind of need to be offering that, don't we, as well?
And I think I did a talk a little while back with a child psychologist, and we were talking about like diagnosing the environment, not our children. Actually, I think so much of the dysregulation we see isn't necessarily to do with anything other than what we're asking our children to do. And if we're asking them to sit for an hour, you know, in a classroom without moving, that's really unrealistic. So, and I think if you look at it, and in a lot of the sort of British Dyslexia Association websites and the National Autistic website, will sort of talk about these reasonable adjustments. And when they talk about kind of movement or brain breaks, it will be suggested about 10 to 15 mm-hmm. minutes, because it's not just the children who need to move. For dyslexic pupils, it will be the kind of mental exhaustion and fatigue that they're experiencing after 10 or 15 minutes. So everyone kind of needs that reset, that get up, move. And I think if you look at your lesson in those chunks, and kind of, it becomes so much easier to work that into. So that's kind of one of my biggest things.
And I guess this goes with it. Good autism practice is good practice. Everybody will benefit from movement breaks. Everybody will benefit from having something predictable. Everyone will benefit from having visuals in the room. Even if it's not a need, it's a want often.
Seriously, and I had a visual timetable up to the whole class. Yeah. You know, then it benefits, again, it benefits everybody.
Okay. I think this is a good one. This is more of a behavior related one, but I always see behavior as communication. So I feel like it is communication.
My behavior is communication top of all.
Okay, yes,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this question is, I have a child, you'll know why I picked this one. I have a child who has become more violent and is hitting out. They were having some time out for a consequence, but I find they just escalate. Not sure what to do, and any tips would be amazing. So first of all, I get this in my DMs all the time, like, what do I do? And my first thing I say is, behavior is communication. What do you think the behavior is telling you? So if they're acting more violent and hitting out, and if time out, so I'm hoping it's quiet time and not they're sitting on a chair, I hope. Let's assume it's quiet time in a room and calm down time.
Yeah.
We don't do sitting on chairs and naughty steps anymore. That's not what we do. We don't do that.
No.
So let's hope it's calm down area or calm down corner or something like that. I'm not going to call it it's consequence though. Anyway, that's them sitting still, isn't it? That's them being quiet and sitting still. Now, if sitting still is making them more dysregulated, so their behavior is escalating, then that means, why don't you try the opposite, I would suggest.
Definitely when they're already being violent and hitting out, I would be encouraging them to get moving and get outside and move their bodies. But ideally, it would be even before that starts. So think about what are the triggers are, what makes them violent and hitting out. Is it losing a game? Is it a busy environment? Is it when there are lots of people in a closed environment? Is it when there's bright lights? Like, there'll be something. There'll be some kind of trigger, because no child is naturally like that when they are calm and regulated and feeling safe and secure and understood and all of those things.
Yeah.
So there'll be some kind of reason. Ideally, you would reduce that reason and those demands so that they was less likely to happen. Yeah. If you couldn't avoid it, I would be offering regular movement breaks and sensory breaks, because obviously what this child is needing, mm-hmm. and praise for doing that as well. Yeah. And yeah, get away from this kind of timeout and consequences. Quite old school thinking, actually. I feel like it's a lot of our background in the 90s, like, or lots of us grew up in the 90s, that was kind of what was encouraged. That was how it was done. That was how child managed, like, behavior management was sorted. Lots of the teachers now go back to that.
Yeah.
And it's not actually done like that now, is it? It's much more about seeing what the triggers are and trying to reduce those, giving regular sensory breaks and calm down breaks, rather than it being a consequence, actually being something the child might request. You know, I need a break, and that's encouraged, and that's actually praised that they might need a break from that. I don't know if you have anything to add.
No, I was just going to say about unpicking that behavior. Mm-hmm. Why did that behavior happen? But like, we don't, like, in my setting, especially in my classroom, we really try to not react, which is really tricky. And actually, it takes a long time to, because it's almost like an instant react. Not reacting, but trying to, not reacting in a negative way, but trying to think, what are they, like, generally, what are they communicating?
Yeah.
They're trying to gain my attention. Okay. And then if it's quite big behaviors, it's not about teaching them the skills in that moment, because if they're not regulated, they're not ready to learn.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think
keeping them safe in that moment, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's, we've come a long way with different things. And I think one of the big things is definitely not seeing, like, giving them a reward, not seeing it as, oh, I'm giving them a reward for that behavior. It's, you're supporting their regulation. You are stopping them from becoming even more dysregulated or even more heightened. Actually, you're trying to meet their needs.
Yeah, because we're attached to a mainstream school, and I hear that a lot, that they're just being rewarded for their negative behavior. You're just reinforcing their bad behavior. Like, it's a real concern. Like, I totally get what it looks like. Yeah. I get that this child has thrown this chair and you've removed them and spent some lovely quality time together and given them a massage. Like, I get what that looks like. I can see why somebody that doesn't understand that thinks, yeah, then he'll just do it again. He'll just throw a chair again and then he'll get a massage. I'm like, yes, but you have to remember, we're an education setting. We're not a behavioral change unit. We are here to educate them. And in this moment, they need to be regulated. They need to understand that maybe I don't need to throw chairs. Maybe I need to just ask for a squeeze and a break. And, mm-hmm. and that's the learning in that moment. Yeah,
I agree. And actually, I'll hold my hand up and say, a few years ago, I'd see it.
Yes,
but right, they've just had that negative behavior towards that other child, quite physically aggressive, and now they're getting a reward.
Yeah, they need a consequence.
But, I think being able to reflect as a practitioner and say, and you know, you change your practice.
I'm all changed again.
And then actually implementing those communication strategies at the right time, teaching how to gain attention properly, teaching how to actually, if they're, for example, a good one's always pushing. I always think, why are they pushing? Are they pushing for attention? Is it that sensory? Is it to do with their hands? Is it full body movement? We're really, really lucky at my school. We've got some amazing spaces. And we've got a room called the balance room, and it's got some, like, suitable for, like, appropriate climbing, you know. So it's being able to climb and let out energy
if you're in a school that doesn't have those amazing things. There are things you can do. So, like, we've got car tires in our playground.
Yes.
Car tires are the most amazing sensory resource. They are free because garages need to pay to get rid of them. So if you're in doubt and you don't have no budget, get a load of sensory car tires. They really great heavy work. Mm-hmm. You're tiring your arms out, so they're getting rid of all that like excess fidget energy, so that you can lift them and build a tower. You can push them over, and it's really satisfying to push over.
Yeah.
They splash everywhere because there's water in them, and they're really heavy and hard to push. You can roll them, you can sit in them, and it's free. So don't just think just because I haven't got any budget that yeah. you can't do this stuff, because you absolutely can. You can push against a wall, you can do deep pressure squeezes with each other, they or on themselves. You know, there are lots of free ways of doing this, so I don't want that to be a reason. It's just about educating on the free ways of doing this, isn't it?
Yeah. And also sort of like wrapping themselves up, like rolling, like you say, like a sausage roll. So yeah. you know, you hold the blanket, roll yourself up like a sausage roll, and it's like that tight, you know. Sometimes
it doesn't have to be an expensive light sock.
Yes, love a light sock.
It doesn't have to be an expensive weighted blanket, even though they're not as expensive now, and they're much more affordable. But it can literally just be a blanket
yeah.
and be waddled like you would a newborn, yeah. for the same reason. They feel comforted by that and grounded. Even carrying water bottles, 2 liter water bottles in a rucksack. And at the front, that can, and again, it's a really free resource. You'll already have had those things in your cupboard, and it just grounds their shoulders and grounds them. I used to, when they used to have massive Argos catalogues, they don't do them anymore, but I used to send my child on a job to the teachers upstairs or whatever with these Argos books. It sounds really mean now, but it really helped. You know, you'd have two or one Argos books spread on the side of them, just for them kind of heavy lifting work. Again, another free activity yeah. that you can do that just grounds his children.
Yeah.
Before I move on from this one, mm-hmm. I just wanted to make it really clear that when we're saying ignore minimal behaviours, what we actually mean. So by ignoring, we're not reacting verbally. We're not even reacting with our face, but we can still be there to ensure they're safe. So what I do sometimes is if my child is standing on really high furniture, which happens sometimes as high as my shoulder, a little 5-year-old will be as high as my shoulder on this walk. Now, if I was to say, stand from there, da, 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 that's like so exciting. He'd start flapping, he'd start jumping. And I'm like, oh, no, I really don't want him to be doing that. So what I do is I stand next to him side by side. So I'm not face on, I'm not being confrontational. I'm side by side. I'm there if he falls, mm-hmm. I feel safe. And I'm there if he wants to come down with an open hand like this, so that he knows I'm there if he wants to get down. And I just wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or sometimes I might say, like, I'm here, or down, please,
yeah.
maybe. Often I am just there, and I just wait. And I make it a little bit boring, because
yeah,
it's not that exciting sitting up there. And then as soon as he is down and safe, then I take him to somewhere that he can climb safely, whatever that might be. So why, when we're saying ignore minimal behaviours, it's not like literally walking away and ignoring. And I don't want people
no.
I don't want people to hear that and think, because I knew what you meant, but I don't want people to think,
yeah, no,
ignoring.
It's hard, isn't it, when you kind of naturally will of say course. Things and probably comes across like, oh no, but yeah, definitely not ignoring, oh, they're climbing, I'm just gonna just let them crack on with it. No, you're there, you're
it's just not reacting, isn't it? So if somebody's thrown something really heavy, obviously you don't ignore that, in the sense of obviously you remove that where the object was thrown. Obviously you check that the child that they threw it at or whatever it hit is okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what you don't do is become confrontational with the actual child.
No.
That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's also about like giving appropriate attention, because for some children, all attention, any attention, whether it be negative, positive, that's just, they just want the attention. But it's,
yeah.
again, it goes back to teaching in the appropriate time, teaching them how they can gain attention for an interaction or whatever they do want to find.
Do you think you would ever teach a mainstream?
You know, I once went for an interview. So I was 10 years into the last school that I was at, and I was like, I'd had the same class for 5 years and the same class and then a different class for 5 years. I was kind of just done, and I needed something a little bit more. I didn't want to be senior leadership team, and that was the only next progression. So I was kind of like, I just needed something extra. So I went for this early years job, and in the interview there was these two little kids at the front that were like, you know, doing all the stuff. There and then I was like, okay, cool, picked you two out, like I could enjoy this because like there's still some kids that I know there.
Yeah.
And they kept trying to show me the highest achievers books, like to impress me, like, Meaning, like, look at this book. And I was like, yeah, yeah, that's cool, but what are you doing for these two? Like, how are you meeting their needs? Like,
yeah.
There and then when I asked that question, I was like, yeah, I would be doing a disservice to the other children in the class. Like, I would. I wouldn't have high enough expectations. I wouldn't be pushing the high achievers. I would be nurturing. So I just knew there and then, I was like, this isn't for me. And I just said that. I was really honest with her and just said, I would need so much training. It'd be like starting again. And so different, and I wouldn't push your learners like you want me to. So yeah, I didn't take the job. And then since then, I haven't bothered. I think that just was my answer. Through and through, I couldn't authentically do it.
I think it's I think that every teacher should experience a specialist setting at some point. I know it's difficult. I think you learn so much.
That's the idea of my feed, actually, is to try it, because it's so secret, isn't it? Like, it's so hidden. Like, we've literally got a lock on the door. Like, none of the other teachers in my school come in.
I find that quite interesting.
Well, it's because my learners, like, they just don't really cope with people coming in and out and stuff.
Yeah, true.
So they see us in assembly, they see us at playtime, but actual learning, like, I guess they just assume that we just, I don't know, I don't know what they assume we do, but that's what my account is about. I asked my head teacher if I could showcase the amazing things that we do, because I'm so proud of our class and what we do. I kind of just want to share it. I'm like, why are we hiding this? I want to share it with the world. So luckily, she was very trusting and let me go for it. I think she's a little bit shocked about how well it's done, but so are we, to be fair. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
What happens behind closed doors though, and how lonely it is, because so many people still have the idea of like institutions and like, I don't know, like trying to correct behavior and stuff. Like, it's not that at all. It's a very fun, loving, nurturing, gorgeous place that we have so much fun.
And this is it. I think it's like definitely for the children in my class. I mean, like, it's really funny, really, because mainstream, I know mainstream is totally different, but like after, like, say a half term or something, you'd get back to the class, and depending what kind of class you had, the kids would be, it would take them a while to get back into it. But in my class, they're like, they're just so excited to be at school. And like, the parents would message me and they'd be like, you know, I'm always quite cautious about, like, you know, asking kids and parents about their half terms and stuff, but they were all just like, they were so excited to get on the bus. They were so excited to get to
school. They went to get their school uniform. Yeah.
And I have really felt that, to be fair. And it, like, the class feels like a family.
Yeah. That's the other difference, isn't it? That is the other difference. Yeah. You are so intimate relationship with the children and their family. It is so deeper, so much deeper. In my mind. Do you have your kids for more than 1 year as well?
I don't know, to be honest, because this is my first year there. I don't really know. I think they do start sort of like seeing who goes where, and we have like the early years and then the lower school, then the upper school and the sixth form. So I think it's quite flexible. Yeah, I'm pretty easy, to be fair. Like, I've taught like through year one to like year six, sort of, like, so I don't really
mind, like,
yeah, I think the age of the kids that I've got, so they're like year 4 to 6. I think that's probably like my
age. Yeah, that is a nice age. I had my, yeah, like I said, I had my last two classes for 5 years each. And after 5 years, you are so close with the family. You know their names, you know, like, their grandparents, you know, everything.
Yeah, definitely.
So intense, that relationship, which is really wonderful, and it's something that like mainstream teachers probably would never get to experience, is that like family. It's really, really lovely, and for the most part we're some of the only people in the world that understand their child like they do, so they can share.
But it basically says, they've worked in SEN for 15 years. Do you think the needs of the children have become more complex over the years? They've recently moved to an SFC in the mainstream. I think that's like a
like a hub.
I think that's a really interesting question. I honestly think, because if you go online, there's loads of it's like videos where people are like, you know, suddenly everyone has need, but I just feel like we're better at recognizing it and supporting it. So maybe needs are actually more complex than we thought, and we're just getting better at supporting those individuals.
Then we also medical needs, obviously, like let's not pretend that the younger children are surviving, and children are surviving through severe medical trauma because of the incredible NHS complications. So children are surviving when usually they unfortunately wouldn't in years gone by, which is incredible. How amazing that.
Yeah,
that does inevitably mean that there will be more needs and medical needs in school, doesn't it? Like there's
you can't get away from it.
No, so I think that has a part of it. People like, are having children later, like there is obvious reasons why that would be happening. And I am seeing that my class 15 years ago in a special school wasn't as complex as some of the mainstream children in my school now, which is interesting to me. Like, where were those children before? I don't know.
Yeah, I think particularly in mainstream, I think the number of students that either have a diagnosis of some sort or need one, I think has increased. Yeah, and I do think, well, in the UK particularly, I think there's going to be a point where, well, the mental health services, but also like the need for educational psychologists,
speech and language.
To go like my,
I can feel it. I don't know if like Cornwall's like 10 years behind anyway, but it is so lacking in therapy.
One of my good friends, his wife is a speech and language therapist, and had a really good business competing with like one of the like the big names in speech and language. She then went on her own, kind of separated with her, et cetera, et cetera. But basically was like, in the area that they were, like, she will never be out of work. Like, it's just, and she just does mainstream work as well.
Yeah, I believe it. It's so needed. And also, like, I see the littlies, like, 3, 4 that are coming in, and their speech language is so poor. They're coming in with such poor language skills. I don't know.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. I can't explain why, but I'm definitely seeing it like on the ground. I can't explain it. But even in the last 4 years in my current school, like the children that left in year 6 in my first year, there's no way that we would have children like that again, because there is such, like the need, the children that we are getting are getting more and more complex.
Yeah,
I can't explain why. I'm definitely seeing it.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. And I think I think this is probably just like my sort of annoyance towards like the government, but I just think there's a huge gap between what we can see and what like those that actually make decisions, what they decide to do. Like, there definitely is kind of a real difference in like what should happen.
But don't you think though that all the people that are seeing it are on the ground? We're busy, like parents, teachers, carers, foster carers. We're busy doing the work. Like, we haven't got time to be MPs and be counselors. Like, yeah. All the ones that actually know are the ones that had to, of course, have no time or energy to do it. I think it's always amazing when parents do attend protests and do go there, because my God, that is such a huge ask when you're already doing so much already. If you don't model, it's like assuming that a baby will learn to talk if you never talk to them.
Yeah, I was, when I very first started working in the autism specialist setting, I felt, you know, I was guilty of this. And I said, oh, but they're not responding, they're not using them. And a speech and language therapist said to me that a newborn baby will hear the word daddy 10,000 times before they verbalise it. You don't stop saying daddy because that newborn baby isn't speaking. And essentially using symbols is like that. It's a new language. We can't just give them to people and expect them to know what to do. They have to see us model it essentially that 10,000 times to ensure. And like you're saying, if they want something enough, they'll get it. And also if you model and go, oh, it's crisps today, here's the crisps. If they don't like those crisps, they will communicate that with you. So I can say, oh, you don't like salt and vinegar. Do you want red salted?
Right? Yeah. The whole communication is, it's not symbols or nothing. You can look at me, you can reach, you can run, you can move towards me, you can look at the object, you can do symbols, you can sign. We love it all equally.
Absolutely.
Good, but how great that we could offer all of those options, because something will capture your
child or your person,
yeah,
and they that will just grab them, and then yeah, all of a sudden they've got a voice and they're understood, and this then is it. It's really exciting.
It is, and I think that's the most important thing you've just said there. It's about grabbing the children. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about getting them engaged. Lots of people say to me, oh, I'm doing the routine with them, so I'm showing them that it's time to get their nappy changed, and then we're getting our shoes on and we're putting our coat, and I'm like, that's amazing, that is wonderful that you're modeling that. Mm-hmm. But is that grabbing them? Yeah. If someone came to me and went, today, Rebecca, you've got to do the hoovering, you've got to go shopping, and then you have got to make the beds, I'd be like, oh, no, thank you. If someone comes to me and says, Rebecca, today you're going to watch an episode of Emily in Paris, you are going to have a glass of wine, I'd be like, yes, give me the symbol. So, you know, it's about that. It's about initially getting those things that really grab, really engage, modelling those things that they love to them, and then the other things will come. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
I was going to say something. So we will know what the symbols mean straight away because we can read. So when we're talking about learning a new language, well, I know that's a drink and I know that's chocolate. But if they can't read yet, they might not know. So they might need a few modelling and a few times.
Absolutely.
And a bit of babbling, almost like finger babbling, mm-hmm, to know what something means. So, for example, I've taken the word off of this one.
Mm-hmm.
That could be letters, that could be folder, that could mm-hmm be file. Your widget is actually, I find, quite obvious. Like, you can do it. But actually, it would take me a few times of someone modelling that. Word. And I'm like, oh, right, that's what that means. Well, that's what your child's doing when they're seeing symbols for the first time. Just how they think, especially like we're assuming now that they're analytical, neurotypical thinkers, and we know that most non-speaking children aren't. They aren't literal. They see things differently than we do. And they might look at that image and we see it's clearly a drink, but they might not. It might take them a few times to pair up with that object, to feel that experience of seeing you pressing the object and the symbols, and then getting the object and think, oh, drink.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, I'll do that. And like you say, the 10,000 times, it might be once, twice, three times. But initially, I wouldn't assume that they would know what that means straight away if they can't read. Why would they know? It would be incredible if they could guess it, really. It would be credit mm-hmm to Widget if they could guess yes it straight away without knowing it, right?
Absolutely.
But the thing I like about your symbols is actually they are pretty guessable. Students do pick them up incredibly quickly. We've had four new students in my class this September, and two of them were using symbols with widget symbols with, and yeah, within the first few days they were matching and communicating and like looking at their tablet devices and pressing and thinking, oh, this is amazing, suddenly a language that I can understand, yeah, and speak. And as an educator and a caregiver, there is nothing more satisfying than seeing a young person find their voice for the first time, no matter what that looks like.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And there's just too many stories that I can tell where my heart is just absolutely sank, where pupils
have
just
got to.
I do. You're just like. I think my favourite ones is when they argue with me and they start like telling me no. And, you know, they really get. Yeah, and they're getting their personalities come out, and exactly. I'm like, it's amazing.
Or they do a joke, you know. Yeah. I love that. They're silly with it because it's not just about requesting. I mean, I know I've said toilet, drink, chocolate, crisp. That's the typical standard. However, communication is so much more than that.
It is.
Isn't it? It's relationship building. It's connecting over a film. Oh, isn't that funny? I love this. Isn't that yummy? Oh, I don't like that. Oh, no, get off. Go away. Yeah. Communication is so much more than that. And we want our learners to not just be able to request crisps or not just be able to tap their chest when they want the toilet. We want to have a relationship. We want to have two-way conversations with them. Yeah. And if it can't be through speech, well, it can be through images, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's really important. Obviously, you and I have both worked in settings with non-speaking people. But I think it's really important referring back to mainstream settings.
Right.
That are starting to use symbols with their pupils. And quite often they'll say, we started using them with child A, the Miss Smith uses them with Rebecca. And I always say to them, well, are the other pupils seeing that exposure? Because it's great, absolutely amazing that the teaching assistant and the teacher are using it with those pupils, but actually the whole class need to see those symbols being used as a language, so that child isn't isolated, that they can have that communication and interaction with their peers.
And it's good practice. It will support, it's not going to hinder anyone. I remember being in year six, you know, I didn't have a noticeable need for symbols, but every morning I looked through the window because my year six teacher would write or have pictures of what was happening that day. For some reason, it was really important to me at age 11 that I knew what my day would look like. It doesn't hinder anyone to just know and be prepared and have another language. Anyone can be dysregulated and lose their voice. And often what happens in dysregulation is you lose the ability to negotiate, communicate how you usually would, make choices. That's not just autistic people. That is not just neurodivergent people. That is not just those who have a learning disability. All of us lose the ability to communicate how we would if we're dysregulated, if we're upset, if we're angry, frustrated, tired, ill, all of those things. If those symbols are a language, then that's great.
We're speaking a lot about supporting pupils and people at home who are non-speaking, but it's also amazing for people who speak different languages. Yeah. You know, if you think, if you go to another country, wherever you go, you know how to use the toilet because usually there's a symbol there, whether it's in Arabic, whether it's in French. So, you know, symbols, like we said, they're universal and they just support everyone. And I know that Woven have said it hasn't just supported neurodivergent people, it's supported people and people visiting from other countries, it's supported early years children, people visiting with their younger children who can't yet read. You know, they can now access the animals and say what they want to see because they've, you know, they can't yet access text. So it isn't just for people with additional needs and neurodivergent people. Symbols help everyone, and at some point in their life, one in five people will have a communication difficulty, whether that's where they're born with it, whether something happens because they have an accident, whether they lose speech due to having dementia.
That's exactly it. It's just so many different ways. You actually have a template, don't you, for English as an additional language, where it shows their language translated as well as English, right?
We do. So that's in the standard packages, but it can be bought as well for home accounts if people wanted to add it on. And there's separate, when you go to create from a template, there's just a separate set that says dual language. And when you go into there, there's over 80 different languages that you can translate to. So it works exactly the same. You type in the English, the symbol will appear, and then you just translate that document and it will pop.
Often, so many teachers will be watching this thinking, yes, I have an EAL pupil and I can't communicate. And actually, we had to bring their sibling out of another year just to communicate with them. Or they're good at English, but their parents aren't, whatever. How great that we have this tool on our computer that we're already using for our learners that can help us communicate with their parents, or just helps them embed, you know, their learning faster. And how lovely that we can build a relationship with them quicker because we can use their language. Without, you know, taking their pupil or lesson or whatever. And I'm sure that loads of people can relate to that situation, that, you know, this pupil just turns up, because often you don't get much warning about these pupils either. They just turn up, they cannot speak the language at all, and they're clearly anxious. How lovely that the first thing you do for them is not only their language, but also pictures. And it just, what does that tell them? It tells them, we're here, we're trying, we're helping, you know, we're willing to learn your language, we're willing to find a solution. Because how scary must that be, you know?
Just can't imagine. When I went to France, I got so anxious because I couldn't communicate what type of coffee I wanted and what sandwich I wanted. And that was, you know, and that was just asking for a sandwich, and I could communicate in English. And I just felt so anxious. I felt silly. I felt embarrassed. And I would hear that's how some people feel every single day, because they're not able to communicate verbally. And so, our aim is to be able to support everyone in feeling safe and comfortable in the world around them.
It's odd, isn't it? Because that isn't necessarily autism. Remember, they're kids. And also, they're not problems to be fixed as well. And I think that's something that we can easily get stuck with, because it's like, oh, I have this problem. And it's like, I don't know, I find that really heartbreaking.
I think that's
you know, as a society, culturally and, you know, generationally, we want things to happen now. So again, when you're thinking autism or not, we just want things to happen. We want to fix, we want to nurture, we want to care. And what we often do is we think about that issue or that problem and then think about how to strategize it. And we forget that why. And like you say, the why could be because they just want to make their friends laugh or they're having difficulty interacting and they want my attention or, yeah. You know, behind anything, there's a child there that, you know, only wants to really impress, you know, yeah. We all do.
Exactly. And also, like, why do you want to solve it? Is it for your benefit or is it for theirs? I think that's a really good question to ask ourselves constantly as well.
Yeah.
Like, is ripping paper something to solve for you or is it something to solve for them?
Yeah.
Because actually, it's quite a safe way of meeting their need.
Yeah.
Is it really a problem or is it just a problem because you need to remember to put the important bits away and it's quite annoying to have to do that, you know? It's like, it's stuff like that. It's like, actually, this isn't their problem, this is a you problem. And I think that's really hard
yeah.
for practitioners and parents to hear that.
Oh my goodness, I mean, there's such a journey of it. I mean, especially I can think about when I first started, there were definitely things that would annoy me in the classroom because you're thinking about how, you know, you've been taught or when you've gone to the lecturers and how they've made it seem that, you know, you need to run your class or manage your class. And then you're looking at these behaviors and you're like, they're undesirable. No, they're not undesirable. They're actually just communicating something. And actually, I'm really struggling for that. And that's why at the same time, we're all human and you can tap out yourself. You know, it could be that you're having a really hard day and then a type of, I don't know, a verbal stimming can really to you and you need to have that time away just as much as for that individual, let's say their peer doing it can really annoy them. Yeah. Even though they're, you know,
yeah. And I think that's a culture that needs to be embedded within your class, doesn't it? And I feel like it needs to be modeled. So if you're the teacher in the class or the HLTA, usually the others look to you to be modeling that. So if you're not taking breaks or if you're not taking your lunch, I mean, I can be guilty of this. Yeah. If you're not saying, you know, I need a break or I need to change adults or let's switch, then the culture in the class is I can cope, this shows capability and strength, right? It has to start and almost magnify you saying I need a break, even if you're doing it or not, you know. It almost just needs to become a norm culture of like a few times a day just saying let's switch it, let's have a break, let's try just visuals, let's try this, and it being because I'm not coping, and then therefore then it'll build confidence for other people to say
yeah, really important. And about, you know, expressing that as well and expressing, you know, when you think about masking and camouflaging and how easily that can happen, you know, at times I myself a challenge and think of how can I model, like about to go into a school and, you know, I need to show that it can be breakdown and I'll just almost a script for just that interaction to be then have to, those, you know, those staff members to see, yeah, it's actually okay.
Yeah,
you can't
show weakness. I think it's so difficult, especially when someone's coming in from outside.
Yeah.
Like, want to put your best. I'm like, yeah, that too, because I'm so proud of our unit. I just want to like put our best self forward, whatever that means.
Yeah,
but it's so true. Like, all you want to see, maybe we could talk about that actually, like, all, what do you want to see? I feel like all I would want to see is caregivers that really care for and are in tune with the children. I think would be probably the first thing I want to see actually. If they're doing some kind of intensive interaction and if they're understanding the children and all their communication as a whole, I think I'd be really impressed no matter what else was going on.
Is that like a timetable? It'll say now we're doing attention autism,
right?
But all of the class are dysregulated. You're really wanting to carry on and you see those supporting adults like, no, come on, just by someone external. So for example, me coming into,
because they probably really want to show it off because it's probably normally really lovely.
They wanted to, but at the same time, like you're saying, I would love to see,
no,
okay, I think we need to do, let's go into a sensory break and really understanding, and I'm sure we'll talk about more, but understanding that movement's not just going to solve things. It can be the start and it can be absolutely wonderful, but it's probably going to be really difficult for those individuals to sit down, sustain that attention and focus, and, you know, sit there and do all the things that you really want them to do when someone's just walked in if they're not regular, you know. And that's really important. So mine definitely would be about
going, you know, I would love for educators, just to carers, to feel more, just more in control and just have that bit about them. That's what I look for, that they can just say, no, we're not doing the status quo, or no, we're not sticking to the schedule. And I know it's really hard.
That makes me feel better then. I've got a story.
I have Ofsted in December.
Okay, yeah. For some reason, I've been teaching for 15 years and it was my first Ofsted. I've always seemed to just miss them. I think I've always had the class that on the Ofsted are kind of, yeah, that they kind of pass by, I think. Yeah. Teachers are really good at that.
Yeah,
avoiding my classes, because I should have had it about 3 or 4 times. They came into my room. She is a head teacher of a specialist provision school, so I felt good, in good hands. So yeah, that's a bit of context. And we were doing a sensory story, and we'd been doing it for weeks, because I repeat the story every week for about 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and it was probably the 3rd or 4th week we'd done it. It was always good. It was vehicles. Sorry, they're super into vehicles. Pass the first object over, it gets thrown, and it was a really heavy thing, and I was like, okay. And then we're not going to go and pick it up, we're just going to do the next page. That gets thrown by another child. Okay, yeah, let's do a lighter object, that gets thrown as well. And I was like, nope, we're not doing this. Like, I am not going to sit here and pretend that this is usually what happens. I'm not gonna, like, this is not okay. It's clearly, we are not ready for story time right now.
Yeah,
off we went, and we spread out, and yeah, there's people there for 45 minutes, and it was 45 minutes of like trying to work out 10 different individual needs, basically. But you know what, luckily she got it.
Yeah,
and we did really well, but it was exactly that. And I'm so pleased that in the moment I had the confidence to think, do you know what, even if you don't get this in this moment, my kids are not ready for story time. Someone's gonna get hurt, firstly. Yeah. It's not gonna be fun for me. This isn't fun. I'm not enjoying this, so you're probably not either.
Yeah. I think, like you said, cultural, like having that shift, because, you know, again, when you think about interview, okay, there was once upon a time that you would ask about organization and being punctual and how would you structure a lesson and how would you, just not going to fit, or that would tell me is, goodness, that's so much pressure, and that,
yeah,
you know, what are my students going to be doing at those times? Like, I know that routine and structure is of course important and you will have it, but at the same time, it's about, I think, when you're thinking about leading and being with, you know, children that are looking up at you and need you there to support them, right, it's so important. Actually, go back to what you said, Jordan, at the beginning about thinking, is it for you or is it for them? You know, that's all kind of my,
yeah, because at that time, if I carried on with the story, it totally would have been for me. It wasn't for them in any way. Like, they were not learning, they weren't ready to take anything on from there. So yeah, that it just wasn't meeting their need. It's a bit of a juxtaposition, isn't it? Because I often say our classes need to be structured and flexible, and I think it's really hard to explain what I mean by that.
Yeah.
Because it needs to have the concrete pillars of routine that is predictable. You do this, then this, then this, and then this, then this, then this, and you kind of, there's kind of like a rotation, everyone knows where they're at. Maybe their table is always in the same place, or their chair is always in the same place, or they always go to the computer and then this, or they know they're going to have snack time a few times throughout the day, and that's predictable, because anxiety doesn't, yeah. So that's what I mean by structure.
Yeah,
but I don't mean that it's rigid. I mean, we have flexibility within that structure, that it can maybe done in any order.
Yes.
Like the lesson, or maybe sensory diets can be sprinkled in wherever, or toilets can be sprinkled in wherever, or snacks can. Flexibility within the structure of it, and it's really hard to explain it without seeing.
I think it's really important as well to think about what structure looks like. So that can look verbal communication structure. First, we're going to do this. Next, doesn't mean I have to bring in my visuals every time and be like, right, this is what we're doing, guys. Just the structure within my voice. It could be structure, like you say, of knowing, you know, who's going to be in the classroom, and if it's going to be someone different, that they're aware of that, it can come in. It doesn't need to be, as you know, that traditional sense of we do this and then you get this and then happen, because I'm sure you'll agree, but that kind of idea, if you were to come into an actual well-functioning classroom, it doesn't really look
like, yeah, I feel like our baseline is that. Like, we have a plan, but I feel like the kids do this.
Yeah.
I feel like
Yeah. Is that I'm quite a visual person. Yeah. So I think they touch base.
Yeah.
With the structure throughout the day. But each of them, and it looks different for every single child. I have 10 children in my class, and it's different for every single child, kind of weave in and out of the structured day. We call it consistent compassion in our class. The consistency is the band of the structure, but the compassion comes in by letting them meet their needs, sense of diet, crunchy snacks, going for a walk.
Yeah.
Maybe we just missed this lesson today because you're not ready for it. It's that.
Remember, that's certainly, yeah, definitely. And I think that's what it is about meeting that need. And at times it can be harder than others because resources in place, and that's including what if someone's ill, or what if there's so many different things that are going to impact that, and sometimes you're going to walk away and think, gosh, when you're packing your stuff up or you're tidying your classroom or you're going home that evening, that you're reflecting on that. But that's really great as well, like, did I meet that person's need for it?
Every day,
it took me 10 minutes to realize this is what they wanted. I was thinking about this, and there's so many different things that are going to be there, and it's almost like that lovely visual needs to be it needs to be there for us as well, really.
True Like, was the main baseline of the day good enough? And if the answer is yes and we weaved in and out of it, then I guess that we need to give that to ourselves too, don't we?
Right, yeah, it's true.
And we all come with our own expectations of the day. So a speech and language therapist would visit and they would expect to see certain things, or a physio would come and they would expect to see certain things. It's really hard to meet all of these different professionals, and my team as well, they come with their own expectations for the day, and it's really hard to meet everyone's expectations where they're at. We only have so much capacity in my room, as adults wise, finance wise, budget, time, it's all it's all at capacity. So you kind of have to just pick and choose, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You do.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed taking a look back at some of my favorite moments from series one. If you would like to be on my podcast for series two, then please get in touch. You can email me at oursensorykids@gmail.com or just send me a DM on social media, and I'd love to have you on. See you next time.